We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It's another week in paradise.
I thought I'd been about 5 months, honestly, but yeah.
Oh, it could be. Could be. My sense of time is completely screwed up since the beginning of the pandemic. So, starting out, we have a big election to report back on that we will be spending the bulk of the hour doing. But prior to that, Jav, you wanted to talk a bit about a particular incident that happened on Wednesday evening.
Yeah, and interestingly, it got almost no local media coverage, at least not in the TV stations or Seattle Times or anybody like that. But Wednesday night, there was a, you know, the usual evening daily march, and they were protesting up at East Precinct, and the bike cops charged the crowd without apparent provocation. SPD said later it was because people had been graffitiing and throwing water bottles. I didn't see that in the live stream, but, you know, let's give them the benefit of the doubt.
And I looked at video from that event, too, and didn't see any provocation.
Yeah, but the bike cops charged the crowd, and suddenly there was a motionless body prone on the street, and it was surrounded by SPD cops. They wouldn't let any medics near, and it took about 10 to 15 minutes for paramedics to arrive from, you know, 911. And a young man, it was identified by SPD as a woman, but it turned out to be a trans man, 30 years old, was critically injured and sent to Harborview. Now, I have not seen any clear video of what exactly happened, but it was clear that SPD charging into the crowd was what caused the incident to happen. The young man's injuries at Harborview have not been identified that I've seen.
There's a lawsuit that either he or his family or friends are bringing against the city of Seattle. So I think part of that reason they haven't released any medical information is because they're in the middle of a lawsuit right now.
And I'm sure that will come out in the course of the lawsuit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, clearly SPD critically injuring a nonviolent protester in the process of arresting him, because they did arrest him. And that's probably why there was the delay in seeking medical attention, because they had to arrest him first. Didn't matter if he was dying. And the man's condition has been upgraded to serious, so he's out of the woods. Fortunately, they didn't kill him, but they nearly did. And, you know,
well, that doesn't speak to any long-term injuries he may have sustained.
Yeah, we don't know that yet. We don't know that yet. And I'm sure that would come out in the course of the lawsuit too. But this keeps happening with SPD, and this is probably the most serious injury of the literally hundreds of injuries SPD has inflicted over the past 5 months. But SPD has said almost nothing other than, you know, we apprehended the woman because they misgendered him, you know, on top of everything else. You know, it's local media paid absolutely no attention to it that I could see. I didn't see any headlines. I didn't see any stories, nothing. Because it was just a daily march, and those marches have become so routine that they're not getting media coverage any longer, except for the live streamers who follow the march around.
Yeah. Now there was some body camera that was, posted online about, it was a video taken from one of the body cameras from one of the officers on the scene because the protester was surrounded by a number of Seattle police officers. And the SPD had said, you know, we tended to her, you know, misgendering him. And you can see in the body camera them saying, hey, get a medic in here, get a medic in here. And then the police medic shows up. a cop with riot gear on, a baton on his belt, and a gun in a holster, and a helmet with a red cross on the back of it. And the police medic does nothing, literally just stands over the protester and says, hey buddy, open your eyes. Hey buddy, can you sit up? Hey buddy, open your eyes. Can you open your eyes? Does not check his breathing, does not check his pulse, doesn't do anything really for him. So I just want to say that, you know, the SPD may have this charade that they're doing of tending to injured people during demonstrations, but that person is either not a real medic, or if they have medical training, their cop training trumps that and doesn't allow mm-hmm. them to actually provide any medical assistance to people.
And the body cam footage also was did not clarify what actually happened to injure the person.
Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't.
We still don't know.
Yeah, we still don't know what happened to them.
All right. Well, hopefully more will be coming out soon, at least from the family.
And,
appears to be moving
and hopefully, hopefully the person will recover, you know?
Yeah, yeah, hopefully.
That it's just so, you know, it really emphasizes why the SPD culture has got to be rooted out. It's such a problem, and the bike cops are the worst, honestly.
Yeah, you know, just in a city where so many people ride bikes and commute by bicycle to watch these demonstrations and to see how cops use bicycles as a weapon against people and in a really violent way is unnerving.
Yep.
All right. Let's move on. Had a national election and lots of local races to cover. Let's start there.
Yeah, let's start with local. You want to do the honors, Maria?
Sure. First off, I want to say that voter turnout was the big winner this year, with an estimated 80.53% of registered voters casting ballots in Washington State. In King County, the percentage was even higher, with a turnout of 83.84%. As of Friday night, there were only about 14,000 ballots left to count in King County and about 137,000 to count statewide. The largest share of those were in Skagit and Yakima counties, with over 25,000 votes in each county. And my guess is that their county elections departments were just overwhelmed with the high turnout. And, you know, it's been really hard to get and train new poll workers during a pandemic, especially when a lot of elderly poll workers have decided to stay at home to avoid COVID-19. So for any close races in those counties, folks are going to have to wait probably another week until all of the votes are counted in certain counties. But here in King County, the results have pretty much been decided, and there really were no close statewide races or King County races until you get down to a couple of King County Superior Court races that were close. But for the statewide races, of course, we see Democratic Governor Jay Inslee taking his third term with 57% of the vote as of Friday.
And I have to say the most disturbing part of that is Lauren Culp getting 43% as a spectacularly unqualified Republican candidate.
Oh, yes, definitely from the Trump wing of the party, which really makes you wonder about who's supporting that kind of stuff.
And with no serious administrative experience at all. None.
Yeah, we'll talk about this a little bit later, too. But high turnout in the past we've always assumed it favors the Democrats, but it can be a double-edged sword. And I think that was really true in this election. Now, for Lieutenant Governor, former congressional representative for the 10th District, Denny Heck, is winning that race over Marco Lias. And that's not bad news, necessarily. I supported Marco Lias, but I think Denny Heck is also a fantastic candidate and will do a good job in this position.
And if Inslee should become part of the Biden cabinet, which is distinctly possible, or some mm-hmm. other, you know, sub-cabinet position, you know, Heck would be the acting governor, and he's got the kind of experience that lends itself to that. So that's not it wasn't my pick either, but he's well qualified. That was one of those races where it's really hard to go wrong.
Yeah, pretty difficult to go wrong there. Now, for Secretary of State, the Republican incumbent Kim Wyman leads Democrat Gail Tarleton by 53% to 47%, and we're not expecting that to flip at all. Wyman's been doing a pretty good job so far as Secretary of State, and that's pretty okay in my book. Now, for State Treasurer, Democrat Mike Pelliciotti won 54% to Republican Dwayne Davidson's 46%. For State Auditor, Democrat Pat McCarthy took that with 59%, which is good. But again, you look at Republican Chris Leyba, who was completely unqualified for this position, and the fact that he got 41% is pretty disturbing. For the Attorney General's Office, Democrat Bob Ferguson won with 58% over his Republican challenger, who won 43%. For Commissioner of Public Lands, Democrat Hillary Frantz will have another term. She took 57% of the vote. Superintendent of Public Instruction, Chris Reichdahl, the incumbent, won re-election with 55% over Maya Espinoza's 45% in a race where Espinoza really came across as kind of a clueless parent who kind of a wide-eyed, clueless parent who didn't really know what she was talking about. So the fact that she got 45% in this race, again, seemed really strange and kind of disturbing.
I really think it speaks to party affiliation more than anything.
I think so, too. For Insurance Commissioner, Democrat Mike Kreidler won by the largest margin of any of these races, 66%, which is almost two-thirds of the vote, over his opponent, who was widely backed by insurance companies. So that was probably the best outcome this year. For the Washington State Legislature, just looking at the races here in the city of Seattle and looking at House positions, because there were some House positions that were contested in District 11, which is South Seattle, Tukwila, and South Renton. Position one, former Amazon and Microsoft employee Zach Hudgens, who was the incumbent, lost to the more progressive David Hackney, who won by 61%.
He lost big. It's really surprising for an incumbent. Mm-hmm. And Hackney was badly outspent. It was a grassroots campaign. Hudgens is white, and Hackney is African American. I think that had a lot to do with it, because it's a majority minority district. Hudgens had been there for a decade, and he hadn't done a bad job, but he really wasn't representative of the district in the way that Hackney is.
And I think David Hackney must have run a really good campaign during a really difficult time. Because right now people without a whole lot of money in their campaigns can't go door to door necessarily, knock on doors and expect people to open them and let you in to talk, you know, because of COVID-19. So whatever Hackney did to run his campaign, he certainly did a very good job.
Yeah.
Now, for position two in District 11, that same district, Democrat Steve Bergquist won by 70% against his Republican challenger. For District 32, that's Northwest Seattle, Shoreline, and Linwood, position one, progressive Shirley Hutton took only 27% of the vote against longtime incumbent Democrat Cindy Reuse, 72%. So those are the returns in that race with two Democrats. In position two in that same district, Gates Foundation employee Lauren Davis was a shoo-in with 78% of the vote against her non-affiliated challenger. In District 33, that's Southwest County, including...
Yeah, she had a very bad challenger, which is unfortunate.
Yeah. In Southwest County, District 33, which includes SeaTac and Kent, both Democrats will be heading to Olympia in positions one and two. That's Tina Orwell in position one and Mia Suling-Gregerson in position two. In District 36, that's my district, Queen Anne, Magnolia, and Ballard, in position two, Liz Berry is prevailing with 58% of the vote over Sarah Reinfeld. Both are Democrats. Both are good candidates. I thought Sarah Reinfeld was the more progressive of the two, but Liz Berry is not bad, And she's certainly has not appeared to be like more conservative mainstream Democrats. So we will see how Liz Berry represents the district in Olympia. District 37, that's Southeast Seattle and Renton. Position one, a longtime incumbent Democrat, Sharon Tomiko Santos, won 82% of the vote over her challenger, John Stafford, another Democrat.
And Stafford ran a pretty aggressive campaign, so he did very badly in that race.
Yeah, and I think the difference there is Sharon Tomiko Santos has name recognition. She's a woman of color. She's been representing the district for a long time and has been pretty active in helping develop businesses, minority-owned businesses in her district. John Stafford is a white guy. You know, he's new and doesn't have much name recognition in the district. So I think that's the difference there. In that same district, position two, Kirsten Harris Talley ran a very strong race against Chikundi Salisbury, and she took nearly two-thirds of the vote against Salisbury's 33%. So she will be going to Olympia in January. In District 43, Fremont, Wallingford, Capitol Hill, and downtown, both incumbent Democrats, Nicole McCree in position one, and former House Speaker Frank Chopp in position two, will be returning to Olympia. Sheree Lascelles took a pretty sizable chunk of the vote against Frank Chopp, but she's nowhere near, near winning against Frank Chopp.
They got 32% of the vote, which is actually the most that has ever been logged
really
against Frank Chopp
percentage.
I can remember. Mm-hmm. It was more than Shama Sawant in 2012, for example. And, of course, Sawant used that race as a springboard for city council the following year. I hope we're going to be hearing more from Lascelles also, because she did run a very good – they did run a very good race.
Yeah, and remember, doing grassroots organizing and campaigning during a pandemic is extremely hard, and I'm sure Lascelles didn't have the kind of campaign chest that the money that Frank Chopp would have had as the longtime incumbent Democrat and as former House Speaker. So we'll see where Lascelles goes from here. I think they did a really good job in a really tough race.
Yeah, and they were badly outspent, as you said.
Yeah, in District 46, which is Northeast Seattle, Kenmore, and Kirkland, both incumbent Democrats will return to the House. That's Jerry Paulette in position one and Javier Valdez in position two. So those are the state legislature races in the Seattle area. For the courts, the state Supreme Court positions, Charles Johnson and Deborah Stevens will be returning to the state Supreme Court in positions 4 and 7. They ran unopposed. In position 3, Raquel Montoya Lewis took 58% of the vote over Dave Larson's 41%. Again, Larson ran as from the right-wing Republican wing of the party against Raquel Montoya Lewis. It seemed to me like a very racist sort of campaign. And the same for position 6, G. Helen Whitener, who had been appointed to the state Supreme Court. She's a black woman. She's highly qualified. She won a commanding 66% of the vote over her deeply unqualified white guy opponent. So that's very good news for the state Supreme Court. Two very highly qualified and fantastic candidates will be returning to the state Supreme Court this year. Now, in the King County Superior Court, both of those positions were pretty close races. Hillary Madsen took 54% in a fairly close race against Andrea Robertson, two very good candidates in that race. Now, King County Superior Court judge position 30, this race is still very close, but incumbent Doug North is edging out Carolyn Ladd by about 51% to 48% in the most recent returns. There's about a 25,000 vote difference between them, which I don't think Ladd will be able to make up with only about 14,000 votes left to count in King County. So it looks like incumbent Doug North is going to be taking that position in the coming year for that race. And that brings us to the ballot measures.
Okay.
So, So the statewide ballot measures, Referendum 90, that would require school districts to develop comprehensive age-appropriate sex and sexual health education for all kids in the state of Washington, except for kids with clueless parents who want to exempt them from it. That one was approved and is winning by 58% of the vote, not expected to change.
And as I said with some of the other things, the fact that 42% of voters are opposed to sex education is really disturbing. That's basically an anti-science vote.
Yeah, and I think that gives us a rule of thumb there, that 42% of voters voting against Referendum 90 is probably the percentage of voters who went to the polls this year in Washington State who consider themselves firmly in the Republican Party. So that gives you kind of a rule of thumb for the other races. This year, I think.
Yeah, it's the same percentage. It's the same percentage, for instance, that voted for Lauren Culp, who's never had an executive position in his life.
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to skip over the four meaningless advisory votes because the results don't really matter there, and talk about engrossed Senate Joint Resolution number 8212, which would expand the investment options for long-term care funds to include private stocks and bonds, and including very complex investments like hedge funds, stock options, et cetera.
And high risk investments too.
Yeah, which are also very high risk. Yeah, this is being rejected by voters by 54%. So that one was a little bit closer, I think, possibly because folks didn't really know what was that resolution was about. But it is being rejected.
It's encouraging to me that a solid majority of voters actually read these things and in this case say, oh, hell no.
Yeah. Yeah. And that brings us to the local ballot measures in King County. Charter Amendment Number 1, which would specify mandatory inquests for when law enforcement officers' actions or inactions lead to the death of a suspect. It also provides legal assistance for the families of suspects killed by law enforcement. That was overwhelmingly approved by over 80% of voters. Very encouraging. Charter Amendment Number 2, it would change the county charter to allow county-owned property to be sold for less than its fair market value if it will be used to build affordable housing. That was approved by 69%, which is well over two-thirds of voters. Charter Amendment Number 3 would change the county charter to replace the word citizen with the words public, member of the public, or resident. This would extend legal protections to undocumented workers and legal residents of King County. Again, strongly approved by 67% of voters. That's a two-thirds majority. Charter Amendment Number 4 would allow the Office of Law Enforcement Oversight to issue subpoenas to get access to witnesses, documents, and evidence when reviewing the actions of law enforcement. That was approved by the second highest margin of any race in King County this year, with 82% of the vote. So people clearly, I mean, when the press says, oh, who's really behind this police reform? Well, look at these advisory votes, Seattle Times. You know,
yeah.
ABC News. Look at these advice. Look at these votes, these charter amendment votes. It's 82% of voters in King County. So charter amendment number 5, we're coming down to the ones that were more controversial. Number 5 would make 3 changes. It would change the King County Sheriff to an appointed position instead of an elected one, which would allow people who live outside of King County to actually become sheriff, people who have experience in other departments besides the King County Sheriff's Department. It would also require stakeholder input, in other words, community input, into the selection process for a new sheriff. And it would make the King County executive the person who negotiates the contract renewals and working conditions with law enforcement unions instead of the sheriff. That was approved by 56%. So a smaller majority there, but still a healthy majority saying, oh, yeah, let's take it out of the hands of the police union and out of the hands of the King County Sheriff's Department.
And I believe it was the early aughts that a Republican-backed initiative is what changed the sheriff's position from an appointed position to elected in the first place. So it was about a 15-year experiment that, frankly, didn't work very well.
Yeah, yeah. So then we come to Charter Amendment 6, which does two things. It, one, It, one, would allow the King County Council to pass laws that change the structure and function of the King County Sheriff's Department. For example, moving some duties like addressing mental health crises to a civilian-led public safety response. That's just one possible example. And it would also, it does the same as part of Charter Amendment 5. It gives the King County Executive the power to negotiate contracts with law enforcement unions, just in case Amendment 5 didn't pass. And that was approved by 62%. So a higher majority said that, oh yeah, the King County Council should have the ability to restructure the King County Sheriff's Office if they feel it's necessary. So that was also approved. And then Charter Amendment number 7 changes the county charter to make it illegal for the county government to discriminate against certain protected groups when hiring county employees or awarding contracts. Those protected groups are workers who are family caregivers, military veterans with an honorable discharge, and military veterans discharged because of their LGBTQ status. This was approved by the highest margin of any race this year with over 84% of the votes. So that tells you something about King County residents too. They see something that would eliminate discrimination, and yes, we're all for it, or as many as you can possibly expect, I think. Now, King County Proposition 1 to issue bonds for needed improvements at the county hospital, Harborview. That one was approved by 76% of voters, a pretty decent majority there. And that brings us down finally to City of Seattle Prop 1 to renew the City of Seattle Transportation Benefits District with a 0.15% sales and use tax. Now, the old expiring tax was a 0.1% sales tax plus a $60 car tab fee. This one would renew the district and renew it with a higher sales and use tax, but without the car tab fee. This was approved by over 80% of Seattle voters, which is frankly amazing to me. Who recognized, I think, that transportation is one of our top local priorities in Seattle. So that's the wrap up of the state and local races here.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Some pretty amazing returns, especially on some of these charter amendments and local propositions.
And no particularly bad outcomes either.
No.
No.
Oh, incidentally, with your 42% rule, I believe 43% is also what Donald Trump got in the state so far.
Yeah, so I think that's a pretty good rule of thumb, that average 42%. So when you're looking at other local races throughout the state, the ones that we don't cover, if you're looking at it as a statewide race, about 42% appears to be the Republican number for this for the turnout for this election. So federal races.
Yes. How did the federal races fare?
Well,
go ahead, Jeff.
The race was called for Donald Trump this morning. All the various networks finally concluded that the lead for Joe Biden in Pennsylvania was too large to overcome for Donald Trump. So that leaves Georgia and North Carolina and Arizona as the three states that are outstanding. It looks very likely that Joe Biden will wind up with 306 electoral votes. He's going to get in excess of 75 million votes in the United States overall. That's the most ever for a presidential candidate. The second most, incidentally, is Donald Trump this year with over 70 million. And that should tell us something, I think, disturbing about the country. But it's been obvious, I think, since Wednesday night from the trend lines in the contested states that Biden was going to win. But it's taken a really long time to count the ballots and a really long time for the various networks and news organizations to acknowledge what I think was pretty obvious, at least by yesterday. So it's over. Biden is going to address the country at 8 o'clock Eastern tonight. It's 5 o'clock our time. for people who want to tune in and see what he has to say. I don't expect to hear much out of Donald Trump today. We didn't hear anything from him yesterday either. He had two statements where he appeared in public. One late Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, about midnight our time, I think, and one on Thursday afternoon, in which he basically went off the rails and, you know, accused the Democrats of cheating, claimed that he had won, that there were a bunch of fraudulent ballots, etc. And on the second one on Thursday, it was very interesting because the networks that were carrying him cut away almost immediately. MSNBC was like, you know, 10 seconds and he was out. The first sentence, and that was enough.
I found that very encouraging, actually.
No, I was about to say, and the other networks were all within 5 minutes of a 30-minute talk. So, yeah. I think it was a major signal that, you know, they simply weren't going to countenance false claims from the president about the election. And these are clearly false claims because the president also has filed a number of lawsuits in these contested states over the course of the week. And pretty much all of them have been thrown out. He certainly hasn't gotten what he wanted with any of them. There was one intervention in Pennsylvania by the Supreme Court that basically ordered the state secretary of Pennsylvania's Secretary of State to do what the Secretary of State was already doing. So that wasn't really a major impact either. But you know, so, yeah. I think the strategy by Trump to try and negate the results of the election. A lot of people, myself included, feared that, you know, especially with a close election, that those kind of efforts would get some traction. But so far, the courts have really said, you know, there's no actual evidence here. There's just rhetoric. And we can't make a ruling in your favor or even take it seriously when it's just rhetoric. So they haven't been taking it seriously. The media, at least the media outside the right-wing fever swamp, has not been giving him his allegations and the allegations of some of the more, shall we say, heated conspiracy theorists on the right. You know, those haven't made any headway in reality-based media either. And, you know, what's left basically is Trump trying to get state legislatures to not certify the actual electors for the winning candidate in states where Biden won, but the legislatures are controlled by Republicans. And that includes Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Georgia, Arizona, et cetera. So there would be enough there that if that's a successful strategy, Trump could pull it off. But I don't think he's going to be able to pull it off. It's going to be made much more difficult by the Supreme Court's rejection of the faithless electors lawsuit earlier this year. So really, at this point, you know, if you win the state and if the Secretary of State certifies that a particular candidate has won the race, you have to select electors who will vote for that candidate. That's going to be very difficult for Trump to get around.
Yeah. So what I'm seeing is there's really three routes for Donald Trump if he's going to try to overturn the results of the election. And all three of them are the doors closing on him. The first one would be, you know, to try to go through the courts and have the courts determine that, you know, there was fraud and, you know, we need to overturn the election in certain states. And the courts have not been responsive to that. As Jav said, they're basically telling him, look, just these vague statements don't rise to the level of real evidence. You have to have real evidence of fraud. And the Trump team has been searching far and wide for it, and they have not found any, that they can use in any kind of a court case. The other route is to try to get the elections overturned in the states and to try to get ballots thrown out in the states where it was extremely close. And there are, you know, five states where it's been very, very close, although the Biden's lead in some of those states is widening now so that the number of states where he could possibly get enough ballots overturned has come down to almost zero. There's maybe two states where that's a possibility now. Typically with recounts, like the recount that's going to happen in January in Georgia, a recount, in Wisconsin, you might see a couple hundred ballots, maybe up to 500 ballots that are changed, 500 votes that are changed. You don't see thousands of ballots changed in a recount, even in an election where you have record turnout. So that's not looking good for him either. This idea that the Trump team's going to be able to get thousands of votes overturned or changed in any of these states. He would have to have that happen in three or four states to win the election. And he might be able to get it done in one state, but not three or four states. That's just, I think, an impossibly high barrier. And then, as Job mentioned, a couple of Republicans, notably Donald Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr., and I think it was Lindsey Graham, who said, gosh, let's try to get these Republican legislators to declare that the election in their state was fraudulent and get those Republican legislatures to appoint their own electors and send them to Congress to certify for Trump instead of for Biden. That's, again, extremely hard to do and has not been done since the 1800s. They have to, and federal law really prevents state legislatures from doing that unless, and let's see, I think I have the actual wording here somewhere, unless the popular vote, quote, failed to make a choice in the election. That's the actual federal wording, which means, you know, if it comes down to a tie and it can't be settled by a runoff or by a recount, then the state legislature, or there was massive fraud, then the state legislature might be able to step in and appoint their own electors. And that's a really high bar, I think.
And I think it's likely that at least one state will try that. I think it'll be thrown out by the courts, honestly.
Yeah, and I think it'll get thrown out by the courts or by Congress or by the Supreme Court. So it's looking like Donald Trump's avenues for contesting the election are really closing off, and he really doesn't have a way to overturn the election, which is really good. That said, though, there is the court of public opinion, and I think it's also encouraging that Trump has not come out and spoken since Thursday when the mainstream media just kind of cut him off and said nope. And a few key Republicans said, look, this is not good. You can't be doing this. Many other Republicans supported him in his falsehoods, including people like House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Senator Lindsey Graham and Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. They went right along with Trump's falsehoods, trying to whip up hatred among Trump supporters and could potentially whip up violence among Trump supporters.
Yeah, so, I think that's actually the biggest risk between
that's
now
the
and inauguration.
Biggest risk. Yeah, that and Trump and, might and do we, in his last month yeah. and a half in office.
We have seen right-wing demonstrations in some of these swing states where votes were being counted at the voting centers, especially Arizona and in Detroit. We also saw an incident, I believe it was Thursday night, in Philadelphia where a couple of heavily armed QAnon supporters drove up from Virginia intending to shoot up the convention center where public servants were actually counting the votes for Pennsylvania, at least for Philadelphia County. And they were surrounded and apprehended. But that kind of sort of lone wolf, or in this case lone wolves, actions are very disturbing. Similar to incidents we've seen during the Trump Association or during the Trump administration. But so far they've been isolated incidents.
Yeah, so far. But remember, too, a lot of those are militia groups whose ideology is that, you know, if we can go out and create a massive uprising, then our candidate can rule as dictator forever and, you know, long live the white race, et cetera, et cetera. Those are the kind of groups that we're talking about who are doing these kinds of things. And those are the folks that, we will probably need to keep an eye on and make sure that something like that, a tragedy like that doesn't happen.
Yeah. And we got plenty of those folks in the Northwest, of course. So,
yeah. So what is left
to
count?
Not out of the woods yet.
So what is left to count? I mean, it's so close in Georgia that the state has declared it's going to do an automatic recount. Wisconsin's going to do an automatic recount. Pennsylvania may follow suit, although the gap there is widening. Biden is ahead by almost 35,000 votes in Pennsylvania. Right now there are three types of ballots that are still being counted. One is the overseas and military absentee ballots. Trump has tweeted about those, I think, saying in Georgia that where are the military ballots, because he's so confident that all military personnel are going to vote for him. The other type is the damaged and defective ballots, in which case poll workers, those take a long time to count. Ballots can be damaged in a number of ways. They can get damaged in the mail. You know, they can get wet and be hard to read. When the ink smears, you know, it can be unclear which candidate the voter voted for. Poll workers will be looking at whether or not a person, or they might have been unsigned or signed in the wrong place. Poll workers are going to be looking at verifying the signatures. They're going to look for phone numbers on those ballots to call voters and ask them about their intent when they voted. That whole process takes some time to do. And in a race where we had a record turnout, there's probably a lot of those damaged and defective ballots. In addition, there's a final group called the provisional ballots. Provisional ballots are if you ordered a ballot to be mailed to you and you didn't receive it by election day, you could go down to a polling place and request a provisional ballot. Poll workers would look to see if they would take down your voter registration information and they would issue a numbered provisional ballot that you could vote. And then they would set that provisional ballot aside to be counted at the very end. Those get counted at the end because it is still possible that they may have received a mail-in ballot from you. So what they do when they're counting those provisional ballots is they pick up a provisional ballot. They look up your voter information to see if your ballot's already been counted, and then if it hasn't, they count your provisional ballot. It takes a lot of time too, and there are thousands, in some places thousands and thousands of those provisional ballots still left to count, particularly in Georgia, and that's why Georgia and North Carolina have not been called, because there are a lot of those ballots still left to count.
Yeah, North Carolina really hasn't been releasing results since election night and isn't expected to until next week.
Yeah, they're really kind of holding off on that. So that's the presidential race. I want to talk a little bit about the Senate and the House races. Here in Washington State, we have 10 districts, House districts. Our two senators were not up for re-election, but all of the House members were up for re-election or for new elections in open seats this year, as they are every 2 years. Here in the state of Washington, all of our incumbents are returning, except for in the 10th district, where Denny Heck resigned his position to run for lieutenant governor. In that position, Marilyn Strickland, the mainstream Democrat who was former mayor of Tacoma, looks like she's going to be going to Washington, D.C. Next year. Beth Doglio, the progressive in that race, has too much of a gap to overcome to unseat her. And that really carried over a lot to the national.
What I found interesting in the 10th district race was 15% of people wrote in something. Those are probably hardcore Republicans, because there were two Democrats that made it to the general election. And so there were like 14.6% write-ins, which I've never seen before.
Yeah, that's pretty high.
Those are the people who will not vote for any Democrat under any conditions.
Yeah. So what we're seeing is 7 Democrats and 3 Republicans headed to the House. And it really was not, there was no race that was very close, not even in districts where we thought it might be close, like District 5, Kathy McMorris Rogers over in Spokane, which is starting to turn more Democrat. Yeah. She did. It really wasn't close between her and her Democratic challenger in the state.
She got 60% of the vote. Jamie Butler.
Herrera-Butler. Yeah.
Yeah. She got, I think, 58%. So that was not close
that
either.
That wasn't close either. Yeah. So then we look at the U.S. Senate and House races nationwide. In the Senate, the Democrats had two vulnerable seats, and they lost one of them. Doug Jones's race in Alabama went to the Republican. And the Republicans had 12 vulnerable seats in the Senate, and they've lost two of them to the Democrats. Arizona, where Mark Kelly beat Martha McSally, and Colorado, where John Hickenlooper won over Cory Gardner. But there are still three Senate races up for grabs, and the Democrats need to take at least two of those in order to get a 50%, to just get a tie, right? Now, North Carolina, it looks like Republican Tom Tillis is leading, and that's going to be a really hard lead for Democrat Cal Cunningham to get over. It's about 97,000 votes. With 98% of the votes counted, it doesn't look like the Democrats will take that seat in North Carolina. And then there are the two Georgia Senate races, which the Democrats are working really hard to get. One is a regular election race where the Republican incumbent David Perdue is in a really tight race with Democrat John Ossoff. Neither candidate has 50% of the vote, and under Georgia law, that means they'll have to go to a runoff election in January.
But January 5th, right after the new year.
Yeah, but this looks to me like Perdue may actually win the race. He has about a 97,000 vote lead. And if you remove the independent candidate from that race, a lot of those voters, I think, are going to vote Republicans. So the Democrats may be hopeful that Ossoff will win, but I'm thinking that's probably not likely. And then that just leaves the special election in Georgia, where there were 20 candidates in that race. It was more like a primary than it was like a general election. And no candidate took more than 33%. There were 8 Democrats. There were 6 Republicans, 4 independents, 1 Libertarian, and 1 Green Party candidate in that race. The leading Democrat, Reverend Raphael Warnock, led the pack with 33% of the vote. And that's interesting. Because in that race, when you've got 8 Democrats splitting the vote and a Democrat's leading, that tells you that a Democrat may win that position. There's going to be a runoff again, January 5th, where Warnock runs against Republican challenger Kelly Loeffler, who was appointed to fill this.
Yeah. And she was one of the main figures in the Senate insider trading scandal early this year.
Yeah, so she's
Where they got a briefing on how bad COVID was going to be and then turned around and dumped a bunch of stock. And her husband is chair of the SEC. So she should have known better. But, she is vulnerable. She polls very low in the state of Georgia. And, you know, I think that, I think that Warnock's got a real shot at that race. Both of those, I think, Perdue is got to be considered the favorite in the other race.
Yeah, and that means that the Democrats did not win the Senate. They're just one vote short of a tie.
If Warnock wins. Yeah, if they have a tie, then Kamala Harris as vice president would break ties, so they would control the Senate.
Yeah, so it looks to me like they're just one vote
short of the committee, but. And the runoffs in early January are going to attract a ton of attention and a ton of money.
Definitely.
Because
the Democrats have just about everything at stake. So should I continue with the House races?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So I think a lot of Democrats are scratching their heads over the House races, asking themselves what happened there. As I said, all of the House seats were up for election, and the Democrats went into this election with a 233-seat majority in the House, which has a total of 435 seats. 24 of the Democratic seats were vulnerable. The Democrats lost 6 of those seats, and 5 more are possibly going to also be lost to the Republicans. That's almost half of their vulnerable seats. Now, those were seats in states won by Trump, like Iowa, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Florida. But it also includes 2 seats in California and 2 in New York, where the Democratic incumbents from 2018 have lost their seats to Republicans. This is a reminder that 2018 was really an unusual year with a very high Democratic voter turnout, but not a high Republican voter turnout. Democrats went to the polls 2 years ago to show their dissatisfaction with the Trump administration, and they won a massive number of seats that they didn't expect to win. And this year, the Republicans are taking back some of those seats. Now, the Republicans had 37 vulnerable seats. They've lost 2 in North Carolina and 1 in Georgia, and these were all open seats where there was no Republican incumbent who were running. So all told, the Republicans are really expected to pick up a total of 8 seats, although in those 8 seats, they're still the vote's really, really close, and the results are still not final. So that tells you something about the double-edged sword nature of high voter turnout. Yes, a lot of Democrats turned out to vote, but a lot of Republicans also turned out to vote, and we're seeing that in these House races. Now, this week, it was weird to see that centrist Democrats were blaming progressive Democrats for their own losses in these districts instead of really looking at the high voter turnout and saying, well, yeah, a lot of Republicans turned out and voted for the Republican candidate. Instead, a lot of these centrist Democrats use this to turn against the progressives and claim that policies like Medicare for All and defunding police are driving away voters. But those policies are not in the National Democratic Party platform. And even though those policies have really broad support from grassroots voters inside the Democratic Party, and this is especially galling since progressive Democrats worked really hard to get Biden elected and to churn out voters in record numbers to vote for Democrats all across the nation. And I'm thinking of progressive candidates like Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. They all were campaigning very, very heavily in the last 2 to 3 months to try to get voters out to the polls to vote in all of the Democratic races. To now see these centrist Democrats turn to the progressive Democrats and say, you socialists are killing our party, that's really dispiriting and really disheartening and very, very unfair. So the Democrats are going to retain a majority in the House, but it's going to be a slimmer majority than it was in 2018. And I think 2 years from now, they're going to have to work hard again to maintain that majority and to try to gain back some of those seats that they lost this time around. So, Jav, are you with us?
I think there will also be...
Yeah, we can hear you.
Oh, it's still...
No, you're cutting out again.
It's completely cutting out.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm with you. Can you hear me? Okay. Do you want to try calling back?
No, why don't you go ahead and we'll see. Are you talking?
Okay. Yes. All right. So I think there will be something of a generational reckoning within Democrats, or at least there should be in the coming years, where, you know, there's a new generation of mostly progressive Democrats that have been coming into Congress. You know, people like Pramila Jayapal, AOC, et cetera, et cetera. The Gang of Four will probably be a Gang of Eight after this election. There were more progressives elected. Be a real reckoning, especially with some of these issues like climate change, like Medicare for All, et cetera, that have broad grassroots support but are not supported by the mainstream of the party, Green New Deal, et cetera. you know, those things are going to get pushed under a Biden administration, and a lot is going to depend on who Biden brings into his cabinet, on who the leadership of the House is, and, you know, what if anything can get passed through the Senate. So it's going to be very interesting over the next couple of years. I expect Republicans to adapt a strategy of maximum obstruction.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what they're going to do. And we're just going to have to find a way through grassroots pressure to get through and around that.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, that kind of brings me to, I want to discuss this, but I know we'll probably discuss it more in the coming months when Biden starts selecting people for his White House cabinet. But what a Biden victory means for climate change and for environmental regulations. Now, given that he may not have a majority in both the House and the Senate, I think there's still quite a bit that he can do with his executive powers, like bringing the United States back into the Paris Climate Accord, or restoring a lot of the environmental policies and rules that the Trump administration has tried to dismantle. I think those are going to be his top two priorities when he takes office.
And I would add to that, restocking the federal government with scientists
and
people who can actually enforce these regulations, because there's been a lot of loss of institutional knowledge during the Trump administration. People have been driven out who had expertise in a lot of these issues.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, some environmental groups are pushing the Biden administration to set up a White House team that would oversee his climate policies across all the various departments, something like the Economic Council or the Security Council in the White House that oversee economic issues across all the departments, or security issues across all of the departments. And I think that would be a really good sign if he decides to do that, that would be saying, look, you know, we're gonna tackle this threat that really is an existential threat. It threatens the existence, not just of the human race, but of all life on the planet if we don't actually deal with it. That I think would be a really encouraging move on the part of the Biden administration. It's something that a lot of environmental groups are urging him to do. Now, if you're not as a voter, if you voted for Biden just because you wanted to get rid of Trump and you're not familiar with Biden's climate policy, I recommend you go to his website and take a look at the very detailed climate plan that he has there, and ask yourself if you agree with that or if you think you should be going further, and contact the Biden team and say, hey, I think you should be doing this. I think you should be doing that. Because right now he's going to be getting a lot of input from people. And right now is when he's going to be setting up his action plan for what he wants to do in the first few months of his administration.
And I would also encourage people to contact. I don't think Jayapal needs convincing. I believe she signed on to the Green New Deal. But contact our senators and ask them to press for specific actions in the Senate.
In the Senate. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we're pretty much out of time.
Okay, I just want to announce a couple of events.
Okay.
Today at noon at Westlake Park is an event to protect every person and protect the vote. So I encourage people to go out there, and I'm hoping it'll have a party atmosphere. Because
yeah, I would assume it's still going at this point.
Yeah, yeah, those are the best events, and folks can go down to Westlake and check that out today. And of course, every day is the Everyday March here in Seattle. I believe the Everyday March is on Instagram. Is that right, Jav? And Evening March.
Yes, Seattle Evening March is on Facebook,
and Morning
is on Instagram. No, morning, I'm sorry. Morning is on Facebook. Evening is on Instagram.
Or something like that.
Yes. Yes. Morning March Seattle on Facebook and Seattle Evening March on Instagram.
Uh-huh.
All right.
Okay.
Well, we will talk to you both then again next week.
Yep. And
yep.
I plan to get a little rest this week.
Yeah, good.